Hello, this is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in our studio author Robert Devereaux McAleese. He lives in Bellevue, Washington, and has traveled over to be in our studio. Raised in Washington, D.C., Bob succeeded in primary and prep school education. Then he won an appointment to a Federal Service Academy in 1960. He attended the United States Merchant Marine Academy at Kings Point, New York, for the next 4 years. Upon graduation, he spent the next 3 years serving as ship's officer on merchant ships, visiting many corners of the globe, including 2 voyages into the war zone in Vietnam. Bob then entered American Airlines pilot training, electing later to follow a path in their management ranks. Following his graduation in 1964 from the Maritime Academy, he maintained his service as a member of the Naval Reserve. In 1995, he was promoted to the rank of captain and served as a commanding officer of 3 reserve units, all of which were deployed to conflicts in the Middle East. Welcome to our show, Bob.
Thank you, Sheila. It's nice to be here today.
I'm glad you are, and I can see how much your training and experience is related in your book, along with so much more than just what a bio can tell us. So I'd like to begin by asking you kind of a double question: why you wrote the book and what the premise of your book is, and tell us about the title, The Faithful Sextant, if you can fold all that in.
The reason for writing the book is legacy, really. Everybody that you've ever run into has said, oh, I should write a book, but very few people do it. I am one of the people that decided to do it. There was a part of my life that was, I thought, a story worth telling, and it became an obsession with me, first of all, to learn how to write and create a story, and secondly, how to produce something that the public and my family would enjoy reading. It appears almost today that I may have accomplished those things.
How did you learn how to write then? I mean, that's an interesting way to put it. I had to learn how to write.
I did. I went through the University of Iowa writing program, actually twice. I worked with the people at Stanford in the Wallace Stegner program. And the most important thing was I read voraciously. So I created what I call my mentor list of authors. These are people that are, a lot of them are very common names. You have the Tolstoys, the Nabokovs, and what I love to call the usual suspects. However, they're not all so usual. The top of the list is Wallace Stegner, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a man who later ran the creative writing program at Stanford. He was a person that helped shape what I wanted to be and how I wanted to write. Along with that are some local people like Ivan Doig, left a big footprint on me. Also a very local person is David Guterson. I think he's fantastic. And then the subject matter is sort of secondary. We mentioned the title is The Faithful Sextant. This has to do with my travels through life. I started well before the time of GPS, well before the time of cell phones, well before the time of a lot of those things that we take for granted today. So ships in those days, to move across the oceans, had a very simple form of navigation. It was a sextant that measured the arc between stars and the sun and allowed the ship to navigate. It's somewhat of a difficult mathematical problem to solve this, but works very effectively. As I say in the book, if you hand me a sextant and a very good watch and stick me anywhere on the globe blindfolded, I can tell you where I am. So it's a very, very good instrument to have on the cover of my book to give it the feel that I want, that it was the guiding instrument that helped move me through my life.
Thank you. It does become a really strong metaphor and a philosophical tool as you read through the book, that end time. So even though the watch isn't on the cover, that becomes a really good metaphor too. Did the philosophy parts that have to do with the metaphor of the instruments, did it just come up out of the material?
Actually, that's a really good question, Sheila. I have been fortunate enough, and she's outlined in the beginning of my book, very thoroughly. I was fortunate enough to find a very good editor. In a few minutes, we may talk about some of my suggestions for new authors. Finding a good editor has to be at the very top of that. This lady helped me guide myself through all of the little pitfalls that comes with telling a story, telling the story of the thread of what you want to create in the imagination and mind of the reader. The reader, they are your boss. They're the ones that you're working for. I started with a lot of poetry in there in the book, and one of the leading poems in there ends up with the word faithful being used. I've changed the title five times, but we finally came up with the Faithful Sextant, and she helped me design the cover, which is, I think, very striking.
What's really striking about the title is many of us don't know what a sextant is, and so it makes you want to open up this book and find out what you don't know, or run to the dictionary. I did both. So persistence is something that I'm hearing coming from you, the persistence in learning how to write, the persistence in utilizing writing mentors who you probably never met and some aren't alive any longer, but the work they left behind is, if you're looking at it through a writer's eyes, incredibly mentoring and instructional. And then publishing. The editing process is a big part of it, being open to it, being open to how long it can take, and the collaboration. They say that writing is a lonely thing, but actually, it's not as lonely as people think, because we have teachers, and we have peers, and we have editors, and people that are interested in helping our book become the best that it can be. So how long did this take?
I've been working on the entire book, I would say maybe 10 years, but that was partly during the time I had a day job. So it was one of these ideas that took a long time to gel. It starts as a bare bones idea, and then you start putting skin and a heart and everything else on the skeleton. And the next thing you know, it starts looking like something that is fun to read. I think in the learning process that I was able to put in compartments the structure of a sentence, and I will lay that thought at the table for the University of Iowa. They have a great program for teaching you how to construct a sentence. The other part of it, of course, is how to create a story. So you have all of these things coming together, and that is the part of it that the editor helped me, but I also got a lot of help from my mentor authors. Not all authors are good at all things. Some authors are better at creating an atmosphere, painting a picture for you, and some other authors are better at telling a story. The best authors, of course, are the ones that can do both.
I'm picturing you reading the books of the mentors that you listed and more that you didn't list yet. How did you do it? How did you go, I'm getting a lesson here. I'm seeing something that I can use.
It almost brings the hair on the back of your neck up when you read a sentence and you reread it and you say, how did this man or woman come up with this idea? I tried to be very general in all of my reading. I found myself reading exclusively male authors. My own sister then sent me on the path and said, you have a lot to learn, my older brother. You need to start reading some fantastic women authors. And so I did. And lo and behold, they helped change me in very different ways. In that group, Joan Didion is one that I found, particularly reading a session about grief and the end of the book as I lose my best friends and go through the process of burying them in Arlington National Cemetery. Joan Didion's book about the year of magical thinking allowed me to see how a person can express grief in a book and draw a picture with that.
Any other women that you were on your list?
Alice Munro. Sylvia Plath, I think, did some work that I thought was fantastic. In addition to that, Edora Welty has a good book on writing. And Dr. Mary Carr, who's a professor at Syracuse, has written three wonderful memoirs. She also wrote a book on how to write memoirs. I've read everything that Dr. Carr wrote, and she was an enormous help, particularly in the format of the memoir.
Excellent. Thank you for all those references. On your back cover, it says that the faithful sextant tells of Captain Robert D. McAleese as he passes through boyhood in Alexandria, Virginia, to find manhood in the world of seafarers and the Vietnam War. Bob was one of thousands of civilian sailors who brought the machinery and goods to fight the war and found that in doing so, the war was brought to them. That promises a lot, and I know you've prepared to read an excerpt from your book, and I'd love to hear it now if that's a good time.
The thread of my book starts with a coming to manhood, and there's a lot of books like that. All of us have to mature, and there's a process that we go through of that maturation. Mine just happened to leave me at a time in life in the early 1950s where there's some very interesting things happening. Not that they haven't happened to newer generations with computers and whole new ways of doing business, cell phones, etc. But my generation had some wonderful things too. We created music, I believe. We've created the music of the modern world. And there were a lot of things that helped with that. And I mention all that. I go through my high school days. And then as I'm selected to go to the Merchant Marine Academy and come out of there, I purposely left out a lot of that because a lot of books have been written about the day-by-day grind of getting through any of the military academies. So I purposely left that out. I've had a lot of readers ask me why, and I said because I had another story that I needed to tell. As I started going on ships, being very, very junior, you're going to end up in the worst ship on the worst run. That took me to Saigon. So this is the day that my ship finally arrived in Saigon. And that, by the way, was quite an exciting trip. One that we should not have lived through. We went through a Typhoon Fei, arguably one of the worst typhoons in the history of the planet. Our ship should never have gotten through that. We were sinking and literally were saved by one man. That's a fascinating story in the book. This is how I wrote the day that we arrived in Saigon. So this was it. This was Saigon. First impressions are so sticky. I stood up by the rail on the third deck, silently observant, listening, as the small men ran around on the key apron, babbling their sing-song Vietnamese language. American military standing nearby, as if frozen in the heat, a case study in indifference. Taking it all in with curiosity, the noise coming from every direction, the sun never moving, the smell of a million sweltering people, the war, an idea without destiny. I could discern no inkling of a master plan. A picture arose in my mind from the imagination of Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. The trip upriver in Africa, native drums beating to a background of rusting, tin-roofed cargo sheds alongside the muddy, sweltering river, created a strong second impression. The berth selected for our ship, the SS Exhibitor, was a mystery to me, as we had been assigned what might have been the number one primo spot to tie up in all of the port of Saigon. Many of the merchant ships bringing war material to Saigon were old and ugly, but none could have been older, nor in any way uglier, than our ship. And yet, the military selected a spot that was the envy of hundreds of other ships. Between the cargo apron and the main street stood an old exclusive French colonial mansion, now housing the offices of our Navy contracting organization. The port was fenced in by a tangle of razor wire, and the gate to our area, guarded by 50-caliber machine guns in a heavily sandbagged checkpoint. Located nearby, just in front of the old French mansion, lay Hamney Boulevard, the widest of all boulevards. From there, the heart of the city was within walking distance. What luck! We could walk to town, out the main gate, turn right, cross over a small bridge, and we were in the middle of Saigon. The American Embassy was located nearby, as well as an exclusive floating restaurant. Seemingly, fortune had smiled upon us. Still, there was this nagging question roaming around in the back of my mind. If this is such a good spot, what's with the guards and the 50 caliber machine gun at the gate? Oh, we had so much to learn in the land of not quite safe. Indeed, about 100 yards directly behind our ship, floating in the river and tied up to the shore, was the famous Mekong Floating Restaurant. This was an upscale Vietnamese restaurant catering to the wealthy local patrons, as well as American contractors and U.S. soldiers. Just after our arrival in Saigon, an American sergeant told us the following story about this upscale restaurant. A scant 6 months before our arrival, the Viet Cong had placed two claymore mines near the restaurant. One was set in the riverbank, carefully aimed horizontally across the main open seating area. There were no walls needed due to the climate. A second mine was set to go off 2 minutes later near the entrance to the restaurant, designed to kill first responders. Almost 50 people, including many American contractors and soldiers, were killed. And the nearby shrapnel wounded another 80. What a wonderful paragon of death, the Claymore mine. The Claymore is more than just a mine. It is a shrapnel charge meant to be aimed. Constructed in a plastic box, a layer of C4 explosive is located just behind 700 steel balls set in epoxy, backed up by a steel plate. The Claymore is deadly. Once detonated, the steel balls can only come out the front of the box, spreading in a 60-degree pattern, like a shotgun. The placement of this destructive weapon is critical. The Claymore box has to be aimed correctly. Raised lettering found on the blast side of the box read, "Front towards enemy." Now we see one of the reasons the Army requires recruits to be literate. The sergeant telling the story about the restaurant had been in country for most of a tour. His retelling was not a bragging voice. It was not in a storytelling tone or even a serviceman's, "Oh, can you believe this stuff?" sense of wonder. It was told in a sort of manner of fact of a high school math teacher explaining the Pythagoras theorem. Nevertheless, and in spite of hearing the story of the Mekong attack and showing great disrespect for the deadliness of Claymore mines, take a guess where Bernie and I decided to have our first lunch ashore. Well, you guessed it, at the Mekong restaurant. We just had to see what was going on.
I didn't expect to laugh at the end of that. But that's it, a mixture of civilization, ongoing dailiness, elite people with enough money to eat there, and the war. I don't want to run out of time before we get to talk about editing, which was something you said you wanted to explore a little bit. Do you want to pick up with perhaps even how you had to face editing in that part of the book?
I thought that the hardest part would be sitting down and getting all the words on paper. Oh, and doing research. Research is so important. Every author knows that. You don't want to write a book, even with little tiny details that are just glaringly wrong. That can destroy the credibility of your book in just a second. So any author, whether they're writing fiction or anything else, tries to do the research as best they can and present a book where the details are accurate. So I finished all of that. Went through my book, found an editor, and we started working in the Word format. I've become an Apple fan, so I use all Apple products. Microsoft makes a wonderful Word program for Apple, so I use that. And I consulted with several other people, including a chap named Bob Levitas, that those of you who use Apple may know. He's written approximately 50 books on everything Apple. So I talked at length with Bob, and he agreed that using the Apple program to write with was a good idea. Bob's books, by the way, are the dummy books for Apple. So I suddenly realized that I had been using Word for years and really didn't know what most of those little things up in the toolbar were for. That was a learning process. My first cut, I thought, well, my editor's going to find one or two little mistakes here and there and little things that we need to do. She came back with 18,300 changes needed. And that shocked me, but it was true. Everything from a space after the period needs to be one space, not two, like they taught you in English grammar school, because these books are going to be transferred into ebooks. Ebooks are different in format, as we all soon learn, than just writing a print book. It became a long process of learning both Word and learning how to deal with an editor. And I thought, well, at least I've accomplished that. And then we got to the publishing part. Now, I self-published, which means that I'm using Amazon particularly, and also Apple. So my book is available on the Apple website, and it's also available on Amazon. All you need to do is type in my name. And the process of getting those books as ebooks, which is very important today, became a real challenge. And I had to go through learning process again with a bunch of programs to learn how to do that. And I will tell you this, the programs that I took up to learn e-processing, I think we need a lot of work on that. Even the programs themselves in the internet tend to disagree with each other a lot. I think actually Amazon has a lot of work that they need to do yet to get us into the modern world of ebooks.
Thank you. A lot of us opt for finding other people to do that part of the work. I really am amazed at how you delve into a project and educate yourself on how to do it all. I want to spell your last name particularly for the listeners, because you said they could look up your name and find the book. So it's The Faithful Sextant, which is Sextant. And Robert's last name is MCELIECE, McAleese. So they'll know how to find you, because as you've told me, there are a couple other McAleeses whose books appear as well if you just type in the last name. So these 18,000 plus edits, were they all line edits, we call them? They were just about typos and spacing, or were there some what we would call developmental edits,
both.
Restructuring?
There were both. I would say that the vast majority of those edits required, as with the spacing behind a period, one click and you're done. That's one edit gone. However, some edits, my editor blocked out whole sections and said, this is running counter to your story. You're interfering with your reader following the thread of your story. As a person that had just put an enormous amount of energy into writing that section, and she's asking me to cut it and throw it in the garbage can, this was difficult. We talked a lot about that, and she won about 80% of the disagreements over what is or isn't in the book. And for that, I admire her, because I'm a pretty headstrong person. So that's just one edit. It might just be one edit, might have taken a whole day. So one might take 1 second, one might take 1 day.
I think that editors are so valuable for writers, because as writers, our minds go off in some other directions. And also, we tend to put our footprint in the book in places where there's a wonderful scene and nobody needs to know someone's writing it. We just need to be in the scene. So I think that a wise writer like you will pay attention. And also, though we disagree, 20% of the time you said in your situation, you disagreed and won the battle. So it's a collaborative effort. I think that editors are amazing teachers, too, because you may learn from a book, oh, how did they do that sentence? But an editor is going to look at where you didn't do that and say, maybe this isn't reading well for the reader. Maybe we need to look at this. You've told us that you have a second book, or a desire to write a second book.
I have indeed written a second book. Actually, in truth and advertising here, the original book was somewhat longer than Moby Dick. And she, of course, laughed at me and said, "Bob, you're a first-time author. You are not writing Moby Dick." And she was absolutely right. So what we did, we cut out parts of the book, which became the backbone of what I have as a second book, which will be a trilogy. If you will, it'll be three novellas, and it's going to be a lot about my family going back to the Revolutionary War. I had members of my family who fought. I probably had 20 people at Gettysburg, split almost evenly between the North and the South. I've walked all their ground. I've tasted their blood on the soil, and this will be the heart of the second book, including then going into the Second World War and following my father, who was a true hero pilot in the war, and some of the other men that I knew. So I'm looking forward to getting that book out, hopefully in about a year. It's been written, but as I have picked up with the experience, Sheila, of the editing part of it, I figure I have at least a year of editing.
I want to praise you for your commitment to not only your own legacy, but the legacy of your ancestors. I think that split between the North and the South is going to be an amazing tension in the book.
And the listeners will detect just a little bit of Southern accent in my voice.
I hear it.
I grew up in the South, so I used to get Robert E. Lee's birthday off as a holiday when I grew up in Virginia. It took me quite a while to realize that my grandfather on the Yankee side was more important.
Okay.
And I am very open now to both sides. And on Memorial Day, I fly both flags. And some people disagree with that, but these are my ancestors. They believed in what they did. And oh, by the way, there were no slave owners in my family. They were all dirt farmers, and they all stood up and they joined either the Northern or the Southern war effort. And it was very costly, very costly.
So I just want to go back to one thing you said and another thing you said and leave listeners with this. When you first heard your editor say that things needed to be taken out and you said thrown in the trash can, and then you said those snippets, those pieces are the backbone for the second book, I think it's wise for writers to understand that just because it doesn't fit in the book that they think they're working on, it fits in another book. Because in my opinion as a writer, nothing is really wasted. Everything leads us to something else. So I hope that trash can was a separate file called Scraps or something like that so that you could revisit it. I want to thank you so much for coming in today and speaking with us about your book and your process in learning how to write. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheila. The pleasure was all mine.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.